Hi, everybody. I'm Glenda Reed, and I'm a grateful member of this worldwide fellowship called Al-Anon. And I want to thank Jay and Ann and the committee and everybody for inviting us up here. We came up here a couple of years ago and fell in love with y'all. Man, this crowd looks good. Scary, but it looks good. I had a God before I got here. And my God led me to my alcoholic. And my alcoholic led me to Al-Anon. And Al-Anon led me to y'all. And y'all led me back to a more understanding God than I ever had. And I want to thank y'all for that and thank the AA for lending Al-Anon y'all's program, because it works good on our side of the street too. And we want to thank y'all. You know, they say to tell what happened, what it's like, and how it is now. And it would be easy to say it was hell and it's wonderful. And that could be a simple story. But I don't think that's quite what they meant. And I'm just kind of rambling right now and trying to let him take over instead of letting me do it. But you know, the drinking led us down many, many roads. Some of them was okay. Some of them we had some pretty good times. Some of them was awful rough. And since we've got into the program, we still go down a lot of roads. Most of them today are wonderful, but we still have bumps in the road. And because of this program, we know how to smooth out them bumps, which makes it so much better. And I will start. I was the seventh child of a Baptist preacher and his wife. I was the baby. Joe said I was awful spoiled whenever he got me. But I don't think so much. We had a lot of love. We knew we had love. He was a country preacher. We didn't have a whole lot. Back then in the 50s, you know, there just wasn't a whole lot of money. He didn't make a lot. It didn't take a lot for us to be happy. We knew we were loved, but yet there wasn't a lot of hugging and kissing, but just the action, you knew that you were loved. It took coming into this program for me to be able to hug another person and tell them that I love them that wasn't a member of my family. And I'm able to do that today. And I do love a lot of people, and I'm able to express it because of the program. But we lived like the speaker last night, and that's something too. Both of the speakers before me has been wonderful. And then I have to come in here and mess up things, but we're going to do the best we can. We lived in a little bitty country. It wasn't a subdivision, just a little country, little village. And the Baptist parsonage was right next door to the church. The church was right next door to the high school, or the school. It was the whole school. And then the gymnasium for the school was right there. So that was my world. I got up in the morning and either went to school or went to church. And in spare time, I went to that gym and I played basketball. That was my love. And the two that was older than I were boys. So I played with them, and I learned to get pretty rough playing ball, and I loved it. The church didn't have air conditioning heating system like we have now, so when it was cold, I'd go with Daddy out there, and we'd light the furnace. And in the summertime, we'd go out there and raise the windows and turn the fans on and get everything ready. And I was expected to be at church every morning, every Sunday morning, every Sunday night, every Wednesday night. And if we was having a revival back then, it was all week long. It's not like they do it now. It was the whole week. And I was expected to be there every day. Unless you was almost on your deathbed, sick. And so that's the way my world revolved till through my 11th grade at school. Now, whenever I got to be in the 10th and 11th grade, ball was my favorite thing, so I didn't date that much, but I would go to the movies with some friends, date every now and then. So church and ball and school was my world. And you know, I didn't know any different. Everybody else done it, so it was okay. But in my mind, I always thought, when I get grown, and whenever I get out of here, and whenever I marry, I am not going to marry a preacher. And when y'all hear my story, y'all going to realize that I didn't. I got way out in left field. But between my junior and senior year, I had a sister that was moving to Oakland, California, and she invited me to go out there with her. So I went and spent the summer, and really I swear I said I grew up, because I knew there was more than this little community that I lived. And I had a ball. Didn't do a whole lot more other than there was a swimming pool. Got to go to the show. But I didn't have to go to church just every time the doors open. Stayed out there all summer. She put me on an airplane to fly home for my senior year, first time I'd ever flown. My brother came and picked me up, and when he picked me up and on the way home, he told me, he says, "Well, Daddy has resigned the church, and they wouldn't let you know because they didn't think you would come home." So that was my biggest blow that I had in life till that time. And I begged my mom and dad to let me stay in this community and finish school. And a lot of the people there invited me into their home to stay. But he wouldn't let me. He said, "No, you got to go." And the thing about it is, we were favored to win state that year. So he had given his resignation, but he was going to preach through September, and school started the 1st of September, so we had to go over and get me a room and get me lined up in school, and then he went back to this little community. And we moved to a town that was, I can't remember if it was AA or AAA, it was like almost going into college from the little C-class school that I was used to going to. Got me a room, got in school, and I just, every night I would go to bed and I'd say, "I'm not getting up in the morning, not going to go to school, don't like it over here, I'm just not going to do it." But every morning I'd get up, I'd get dressed, and I'd go to school. Upstairs was an apartment, and it was two old maid school teachers living up there, and one of them was from this little community that I moved from, and her sister was one of my best friends that played ball with me. So I would ride with them to work, to school, and come back home in the evening. I'd do homework. We'd do, go out, and they'd ask me to go with them, go get something to eat. And then they would ride around and look for the guys. So I rode with them and looked for guys. For them, not for me. So October got there, and my mom and dad moved over. All my other brothers and sisters was gone, wasn't living at home at this time. And we got a house, and Daddy bought me a car. So I had a car to go to school, drive, and run around. And I by this time, I'd got in good with some of the girls in my room, and we got close, and we started running around together. I went out for the basketball team. I made the team, but I didn't make first string like I was at home. But I did get to play a lot. And before the end of the year was over with, I enjoyed that year. I learned a lot. Got to be with a lot more people. Got out in the world a little bit more. And was a little bit more educated because where the little town that I lived in, it was a dry, we have parishes in Louisiana, so it was a dry parish. Where we lived was very wet. And so I got in with some girls that didn't drink and ended up to be a good school year. But the only difference, it was larger. It had a show right there in that town. It had a skating ring in that town. And it had a big truck stop that had a bunch of pinball machines. So I would go to the show one night. The next night I'd go to the skating rink. The next night I'd go to the truck stop and play the pinball machine. By that time the show would change and we'd just start all over. And one night, I was out at this truck stop, and my friend, her mother and daddy owned it, and it was just she and I that night, and we're standing there playing the pinball machine. And there's a bunch of guys in there that I'd never seen before. And one of them come by the pinball machine and said, "Can I buy y'all a drink?" Well, they were drinking beer, so I thought that's what he meant. And I said, "Nope." He said I was very ugly, but I just thought I told him no. And he went and bought a ram for the group. And by that time, one of the other guys had called us over and was talking to us at the booth whenever he came back with a round of drinks for the guys. And the next night, I had a date with that guy. And about a week later, we decided we was going to get married. Now, at this time, well, I forgot to tell you, I did, after I graduated from high school, I did go to college and stayed in college. At that time, it was a semester, and I stayed one semester, and I got my grades, and one of them wasn't what I thought it should have been. And I said, well, I'm not going back. So I went to Memphis and worked for a while and at the telephone company, and I left there and came back to this town that we had moved to for my senior year. And my mother and daddy had moved back over right out of Ruston, Louisiana. And so I told him, I said, before we do anything, we better drive over and let you meet my parents. So we did. We got off work one night. This group of people was coming through this town because he did construction work and he was on a pipeline and it was coming through this area. That was the reason why they were there. So we rode over to where my mom and dad lived. And I got up and went to the kitchen to get something to drink. And my mom came in there and she said, "Glenda, this is serious, isn't it? And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, what can I do?" And I said, "Nothing." So that's all she said. We left there and we went back to Lake Providence where we're living. About a week later, he couldn't go buy the ring, so I got to go pick out the rings and everything. So he gave me this ring, and my daddy pops in. He was always popping in over there to check on me. So he popped in where I was working. He just got inside the door, and the lady I worked with said, "Well, Brother Odom, you hadn't heard the worst of it." And he just stood there for a minute, and he turned and looked at me, and he says, "He's Catholic, isn't he?" I said, "Yes, sir." I don't know if I told y'all, we were Baptists. So my mom said that when Dad got back home, said he didn't hardly eat, he didn't hardly sleep or do anything. But he married us. And I didn't know till later that they had to get Joe out of the bar to come to the wedding. So him and my dad and the best man was back there in that little room, and he said he was eating everything he could think of to keep the smell. But my dad was so nervous he wouldn't have smelled nothing anyway, so it wouldn't have mattered. But anyway, and my brother gave me away, and just as we was fixing to go down the aisle, he looked at me and he says, "Is there anything I can do to stop this? Are you sure?" And I was okay to them, but when he said that, I was as nervous as I was whenever I got up here. But we went ahead, we got married, and we started on this great American dream. We got a little apartment there in this town, and he worked, I can't remember how long it was, but maybe a couple of months and the job was over. And I didn't tell y'all this either. He's a coonie. He's from South Louisiana. He's a registered one. So he carried me back down to South Louisiana, and it's about as big of a culture change as it is from where I live now to up here, just in the state. Half of the state is, both half is so different from the other. And we moved down there, and we bought a trailer house. That was what they were called then. They wasn't called mobile homes. It's called trailer houses. So we bought a trailer house because we knew we was going to have to be pulling around on jobs. And we parked it there in his yard, his mother and daddy's yard. And every Sunday, people would come out of the woodwork to come to her house and eat lunch. And some of these people couldn't speak English. They just speak the old Cajun French. And after we'd eat lunch, I'd disappear because I'd think they was talking about me. So I'd go to my house and I'd get out of there and just let them have it. And I was raised on vegetables, potatoes. He was raised on meat and rice. And when she cooked rice like my mama made a big pot of soup. I mean, humongous. I thought, who's going to eat all that rice? Well, before the day was gone, it's all gone. It was like that every week. We'd leave. He'd get called on a job. We'd hook up to the motorhome, to the mobile home. We'd pull it to a new job. When he was working, he was fine. He didn't drink that much. And the first few years of our life was, it wasn't a problem. We had a lot of good times. I'd even buy it for him because he worked the hours that everything would be closed when he got off work, and I'd buy it for him. He'd be there when he got off. And one time we were in between jobs, and we'd usually go back to his folks. They had a big yard where we could park there. And we were there, and a guy come and asked. He worked union. He was a union hand. And a guy came and asked him if he'd get up the next morning and carry him to Lake Charles. We live about 50 miles outside of Lake Charles, Louisiana, and carry him to the union hall. He needed to tend to some business, and he told him, yeah. So they got up early and left and went to Lake Charles. And when it got late afternoon, instead of just staying over there by myself, I walked across to his mother and daddy, and he had a little brother that was 6 years old, and sat over there and visited with them and watched TV, but I kept watching my watch, and I kept getting more disturbed, angry. And he came in about 10 o'clock, and he had had a gutful. And whenever he walked in, his little brother looked at him and said, "Bubba, Sissa Glenda's mad at you." And he looked at me and he says, "What are you doing out here? You don't live out here anyway. Get up and let's go to the house." So we did. And I didn't notice that his father walked it with us, but whenever I went inside and turned around, Joe was coming up the steps and his daddy was standing back down at the bottom, and he says, "Son, wait just a minute." He says, "If you lay one hand on her, you're going to have to answer me because I'm going to tear you up." And I thought, I got somebody in this family that's on my side. I never forgot that. Well, he didn't, and he never did. He never did lay a finger on me. Times did get bad, but he never did hit me. So I realized then that we had a bigger problem than I really thought we did. And like I said, when we was between jobs, he'd drink. When we was on jobs, he usually didn't drink that much at first. And one time we moved to this little town. It's Gina, Louisiana. Wasn't anything to do there. So the guys helped us, and we put up a volleyball net, a professional one. I mean, it was huge. They drove the pipes in the ground, and every evening the guys would rush on to play volleyball with us. Well, this one evening, everybody came in but Joe. And here I was getting madder and madder. And then all of a sudden, here he came, and I knew he had a snoot full. He got on the other side. Now, I was a decent player, but I couldn't serve good. But it was my time to serve. And I was mad enough, and whenever I reared back and hit that ball, I hit it straight to him, and I knocked him on his end just as big as could be. And that was the way I got my relief that day. Well, we was married about 4 years, and we had this little girl. And she was the apple of both of our eyes. And he didn't drink a whole lot around her. And everything was good there for a period of time when she was between birth and about 2 years old. And then he decided he was ready to have another child. And I wasn't quite ready, but I said, okay, by the time he get here, she'll be around three. So that'd be a good age for him to get along. And I got pregnant. But as soon as I found out I was pregnant, I had this feeling that I would never have this baby. But I never said anything to Joe about it. But I told a lot of the women on the pipeline. And everything went good. And I was 6 months pregnant. And he got a job up close to where my mom and dad lived. So he carried our home on over to where the job was. Excuse me. And I went to where my mom and dad was, and I was going to get me a doctor's appointment and start using a doctor there in Ruston. I got the appointment, and I went in and saw the doctor. And he told me, after he examined me, he said, "You're not going anywhere. You're going to stay at your mom's. You're not picking up your little girl. She can crawl up in your lap. That's it. That's as far as it goes. You can't do anything. You can't lift. You can have this baby at any time, so we've got to try to hold it off as long as we can because it just won't live now. It's too little." So I did that. 1 week later, I was in the hospital delivering. It was a little boy. It lived for 6 hours. It weighed less than 2 pounds. And they advised us not to look at it. They said it's formed in every way, but it's just too little to live. Today they could probably save it because they've come so far in medicine. But back then they couldn't. And the ladies on the pipeline started calling me, and they said, "God prepared you, but how is Joe?" Well, he hadn't made it there whenever he was on this job, and we had to get a hold of him and bring him in. And it tore him up. And he had to tend everything. Since it lived, we had to name it. We had to have a funeral. We had to bury it. We had to go through everything. And he had to tend to all that. Well, that's when the drinking really went downhill. I don't know if he's blaming himself or what, but it's just, that was God's act, and we can't question it. And after that, the problems really started. And every seemed like almost waking moment that he wasn't on the job, that he wasn't really busy at work, he was drinking. He was like an invalid because one hand had a styrofoam cup wherever he was, drinking all the time. And it got to the point that it didn't matter if I had, whenever he came in at night, if he was working and I had supper fixed, he would come in and he would get on to me. You know I don't want to eat now. See, I knew if I could get him to eat, usually he would quit drinking and then go on to bed pretty soon. So if I had supper fixed, he'd come in fussing at me because I had it fixed. And if I didn't have it fixed, he'd come in fussing at me because I didn't have it fixed. It didn't matter. He said he just trying to get me on the defense so it wouldn't be on him so bad. He told me all this after he sobered up. But that's the way it went for a long time. And he, like I said, he never hit me, but he would get real close and maybe put his hands on me and be loud and all. And our little girl would come and get between us and push him and say, go on, Dad, just go on. And he would listen to her. And we were back in right out of Ruston, where we live now. And my mom and daddy was going to have a fish fry. Well, before this, I never worked because he always made a good living. We never wanted for anything, but he was getting so bad drinking, I was afraid, so I went to work selling insurance. Never sold anything in my life, but I was good. The first month I worked, I was top salesman. Second month, and we competed, Louisiana competed, my company had people in Mississippi and Louisiana, so we competed against one another. And I was the top salesman in both states. Second month, I was the top salesman in both months. Third month, I was the top salesman. And they promoted me to head of a team. My team always won. And we would have to go over to Jackson, Mississippi, and meet with the Mississippi people once a month to have a meeting. And this one particular month, Paige, our daughter, would always stay with him because I'd have to spend the night. And this one particular month, my team had won everything that you could win. I had won everything you could win as an individual. I came back with a whole bunch of extra money, all kinds of benefits. And I thought, he's going to be so proud. I drove up. Now, I had bought this suit to wear. It had an eggshell jacket, eggshell and pinstripe brown shirt, and a brown pair of pants. So I drove up, and here he came, and I could tell he'd been drinking. And right behind him, our daughter came out. And he just grabbed me. Now, he didn't hit me. He grabbed me. Our driveway was red clay. He rolled me in that driveway. My eggshell jacket wasn't eggshell colored anymore. Had to throw it away because it wouldn't come out. But I motioned for my daughter to get in the car on the other side, and as soon as I was able to, I jumped in the car, and whenever I did and closed the door and I locked it real fast, he raised his fist back and hit that window just as hard as he could. Why it didn't break, good Lord kept it from his only reason, because it should have. So I went and spent the night with my mom and dad. Came back the next day. His old fist was three times the size. And he says, I don't know what happened to my hand. I said, I can tell you. And that's the first time I knew that he was in, had blackouts and didn't know what he would do. And the daughter got older. And she got to the point that she didn't want to leave my side. So she'd always stay real close to me. And one time my mother and my two sisters was going up to Tennessee around Nashville. And she wanted to go, but she was scared to leave me. And I said, I'll be all right. So she went with them. And they said the first night that they stayed in that the motel room going up, said the phone rang about 2 o'clock that morning and said she went into hysterics because she thought something had happened to her mama. That's how this disease affects the members of it. But it was a wrong number. Anyway, on this particular day that we were going to go over at my mom's and have a fish fry, the night before I told Joe, I said, now we're going to go over there and have a fish fry. And some of my dad's people were coming over and they were all big in the church. And I said, would you please for me, just please be okay tonight. And he says, tomorrow night. I said, come in from work, don't drink, and come over and eat fish. He says, I will, I promise. Well, I was in there helping my mom that evening, and a few minutes, here comes my daughter, and she run through and run to another room. Well, I knew Joe had drove up, and I knew he was drinking for her to disappear because she didn't want to be around him. And so I went outside, and I met him. And this is the first time that I used Al-Anon, but I didn't know I was using it because I didn't know anything about Al-Anon. I just looked at him, and I said, you get in the truck. You go home, do not come back, and we'll talk about this tomorrow. And much to my surprise, he minded me. So the next morning when I went home that night, I stayed with Paige up in her room. The next morning I told him, I said, this is it. I've had enough. Paige and I are leaving. And he says, no, you ain't got to. I'm not going to take the home away from my daughter. I'll leave. So y'all that heard his story heard him say how he got the Piggly Wiggly bags and started packing in the Piggly Wiggly bags. Now, we did have suitcases, but he said he thought he'd make it as pitiful as he could. So maybe I'd say, oh, you can stay. But I didn't. And he left. And he stayed gone for a good while. One day he come back. Now I'd gone to work at this time. He came back and he brought me some money. And he says, well, I thought y'all might need a little help. And I brought you some money to help out. I said, okay, thank you. And he left. The next day he came back. And you know they say some of us are sicker than others. He came back and he says, I need that money. And I give it back to him. So everything rocked on for a few weeks. He didn't come back, and it was getting the spring of the year, and one day he can't pop back in. And he always raised a garden, and he says, I come back over here to raise a garden for you and Paige. Y'all might need it, if you don't mind. I said, I don't mind. Just get out there and do what you got to do. So he got out there, and he was working in the garden, and the phone rang. And it was his mother. And she knew nothing what was going on up here. So she was telling me that her sister, which was Aunt Lena, had died. And I said, well, just a minute. Let me get Joe and let you tell him. So I hollered at him. And he came in and he talked on the phone with her. And he got off. And he started pacing in the house. Well, I knew what was coming. And he says, can Paige go with me to the funeral? I said, if she wants to. And a little bit later, he kept on and he said, will you go with me? And I said, nope. It'll make you think you can get back in this house and you're not coming back in. No, it won't. I promise you. I will not try anything. Everything will be fine. I know where I stand if you'll just go with me. And I kept saying no, and he kept on. And he says, you know, Aunt Lena loved you and Paige probably better than anybody in the family. And she really did. She really cared a lot about us. And I finally give in. I said, but you got to realize I'm just going for this, and you're going to go back to Monroe where you're staying when we get back. He says, I promise you. Well, we packed up and we went. Our car was bucket seats in the front. Paige was sitting in the back. Every chance he got, he'd reach over and touch my shoulder or my leg. I'd just move it off, and Paige would snicker, you know. We did this all the way down, about 3 hours. We got to the funeral home, went in, and one of his sister-in-law said, well, I'll take Paige and go out to my house with her. So they left, and Narlin asked his mother, or Joe, he's one and the same. Joe asked his mother, said, have you had anything to eat? And she said, no. And he said, would you eat if we carried you out to eat? And she said, I sure would. So we carried her out to eat. When we come back, I was in the back seat. And, you know, from getting out of a two-door car, you kind of have to bend over to get your head out. And wherever I came up, he kissed me. He knew I wasn't saying anything. So we went back in the funeral home. And after a while, it was getting late. And his mother says, his daddy had passed away at this time. His mother says, I'm not going out. I'm staying here all night. Y'all just going out to the house, and I'll see you tomorrow. And I thought, oh, my gosh, here we're going to be stuck out there all by ourselves. So we did. Got out there, and her house was, it was kind of a square where it was two bedrooms. It was a bathroom in between, but you could go through there into the living room, the kitchen, back to that bedroom. So it was just a square you could walk. And he asked me, he says, which bedroom do you want? And I said, doesn't matter. Just pick yours. He said, no, you go ahead. So I picked one, and he come in there, and he says, can I go to bed with you? And I said, nope. And he said, please. And I said, you promised me. And he said, okay, I'll back off. So he did. And whenever I went to sleep, he was making that square, just walking. And during the middle of the night, something woke me up. Y'all getting ahead of me. He had pulled a chair up to the foot of my bed, and he had propped his feet on the foot of the bed, and he's had asthma all his life real bad, and he snores, and his snoring is what woke me up. And I sat up in bed, and I looked at him, and you know, you've always heard there's a fine line between love and hate. Well, I thought I had passed over that line. I thought the drinking had made me pass over the line. But whenever I sat up and looked at this man, I knew I still loved him. But I knew I couldn't live with him like he was drinking. So God was doing for me there what I couldn't do for myself. So we went back home, and he went back to Monroe and went to work. I had an opportunity to move to Tyler, Texas with an insurance company. So Paige and I moved out to Tyler. And I always went to work out there and was work. And we would come home every 2 or 3 weeks on the weekend. And he came home one time, and we wasn't there. So he thought, well, I'll move back in, and I ain't have that much more money to drink on, you know. So he moved back in the house, and I came home one weekend, and he was there. And I walked in, and I said, oh, didn't know you was here. I'll go stay at my mom's. And he says, well, I didn't know you was coming, but you can if you want to. I'm fixing to go to another one of those AA meetings. And my ears kind of perked up because I really wanted him to do something about his drinking. So I thought, well, I'll stay around. And when the guy came to pick him up, he wasn't quite ready. So this guy sat down in the living room, and he and I had a conversation. I don't remember anything that was said other than one thing. And he told me, he says, Glenda, it does not matter whether you and Joe get back together or not. He said, the only important thing is that he never takes another drink. And I knew that was true. So he came out, and they went to a meeting. I stayed there that weekend, but I stayed up in the front of the house with my daughter. He went to a meeting the next night, Sunday. I got up, went to church, and I went back to Tyler. Oh, I did find out that I needed my church after I didn't have to go, you know. So I got back in church too. It takes the church and Al-Anon to keep me whole. I need all the help I can get. So I went back to Tyler, and we started talking some, and he kept telling me he was going, keep going to the meetings, and I'd come home every now and then, and I would stay in the opposite end of the house. And I could see an improvement in him. I could see things. I could tell he had changed. So one day I called him and I said, Joe, would you like to come out to Tyler and spend the weekend with me and Paige? And he said, I would love to. So that Friday, he got there. We were living in an upstairs apartment. He got there, knocked on the door, and I let him in. He almost got to put his suitcase down, and another knock came on the door. And I opened the door, and it was a little short, bald-headed man. And he said, is Joe Reed here? And I just stood there because it just caught me off guard. And he says, is Joe Reed here? And I said, yes, right in here. So he just pushed right by me and came in, and he said, are you Joe Reed? And he says, yes, I am. And he says, I've come to get you to take you to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. He says, I ain't come here to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And he said, well, a guy in Arcadia, Louisiana called me and told me not to take no for an answer if I had to sit on the foot of your bed till you went. So that was the guy that came to the house the night that told me that the most important thing was for Joe not to never take another drink. So he went to an AA meeting. He went the next night. And he stayed over longer, and he went every night he was there with this guy. And he'd go with him during the day while I worked and ride around with him. And my company moved me from Tyler to Longview, Texas, and he helped me move. And while we were moving, he had his truck pulled up on the walkway to my apartment. And the mailman was coming up the drive, and he says, he's going to be mad at me because I'm in his way. But whenever he got up there, Joe was standing inside the bed of the truck, and the postman put his elbow up on the truck, and he says, are you Joe Reed? And he says, yeah, are you from AA? And he says, yeah, we'll go to a meeting tonight. So when they say the long hand of AA reaches out, we're proof that it does. So he went back home not long after that and went back to work. And I got my daughter in school in Longview, and the school there, just her class was bigger than her whole school back home. And she didn't like it. So everything was going good between him, so I moved back home. We got back together. And, man, we've been having the time of our lives. If you're new here, you need to put on your boots and get ready for the ride because it's wonderful. If you stay around, the miracle will happen. And my daughter got in high school or in junior high, and she was in everything. So I couldn't go to meetings like he did. I had to be there and support her, and I went ever. But the first meeting I ever went to, this guy that was his sponsor took us to Arkansas State Convention. And the first time I ever heard anybody talk was from a podium like this. And he got up there and he said his name, and he says, and I'm an alcoholic and I'm proud of it. And you know what went through my mind? I said, man, you are crazy. Who would want to be an alcoholic? But you know, before that weekend was over with, I knew what that man meant. He knew his problem, and he knew what to do about it. And I was real impressed with this setup. So we went back home, and like I said, I went every chance I got. And Joe went all the time. And when Paige got in high school, she got on the homecoming court and all this, and she even asked her daddy to to Walker, and he did. That was a fringe benefit because I never thought that would happen. We'd go to a meeting. She had got to when she was little. She got to where she didn't want anybody to come to our house because she didn't know how her daddy was going to be with her drinking, and she didn't know how her mama was going to act. So after we got in the program, we'd go to the program some night, and we would come home, and our house would be full of little girls. Well, they'd got to be pretty good, pretty big-sized girls by this time. But we'd be walking over them to get to our room. And they all got to where they called us Mom and Dad. They said, "You're our second Mom and Dad." That's because of this program. She went to college at Louisiana Tech. She became a nurse. Right as she went into college, she got married. She asked her daddy to give her away. So he got the privilege of doing that. And she hadn't been going. She went, and she had always said from the time she was about 4 years old that she wanted to be a nurse and work with babies. Well, when she started college, she says, "I think I'm going into medical records." Well, I knew she wasn't going to be happy. But I said, "Okay, whatever." So she got that degree, and then she came. She said, "I'm not happy. I want to be a nurse." So she went back, and she got her RN. And while she was going to school to be the RN, she got pregnant and had this little boy. That's my boy. That was my love. And I had to keep him a lot because she went back to school. And right here on this hip, we bonded. He's 21 years old today. Never seen his grandpa take a drink. 4 years later, she gave us this little girl. She's 18 today. She just started college. And you know, because of this program, we hug, we kiss, we tell each other we love each other. They don't ever call me, or I don't ever call them, or they don't ever call, come to my house or leave, that they don't hug me and tell me they love me, and I do the same. And I couldn't have done that without y'all. They're special kids. My daughter never gave us any problem. To this day, they've never given us any problem. Don't know what tomorrow brings, because they're in college. A lot happens there. But you know, been around here for, I know my date whenever I first came here. It was August the 4th, 1978. So I had 30 years in August. And people will ask me, "Why do you keep going?" And I say, because somebody was in that room whenever I walked in. And I want there to be somebody there when a newcomer walk in. And you know, we're just like y'all, the alcoholics. We do everything we can do before we walk in those doors. We've tried everything. I knew Joe loved me enough that he would quit drinking. I tried everything in the world to make him stop drinking. It didn't work. He couldn't do it for me. And I like to tell these women and men, we have a good many men in our group, that you know when you walked in the doors of Al-Anon, you hadn't walked into heaven, but you walked into the next best thing, because anybody in here will do anything for you. And I was so glad whenever I heard about the three C's, because see, all these years that he drank, I caused it. And whenever they told me in those rooms that I didn't cause it, it was a relief. And Lord knows I tried so many years to control it, and it didn't work either. And I'm not God, so I can't cure it. And you know, all the years that Joe was drinking, people used to tell me he's just sorry leaving. All the earth people, I like to call them earth people. And I knew that there was something in that body that they didn't know about. So whenever I got into the room of Al-Anon and they told me that he was sick and not necessarily sorry, I heard it loud and clear. He got to the program before I did. He's got a few months on me, but like I tell him, he needs something on me, you know. You know, I know that I didn't make him an alcoholic, but I know that I made him drink a lot more because of my mouth. You know, he would just show me and he would drink more. And he told me one time that if he cut off my head, my tongue would still wag. And he always told me, he said, you're like an elephant. You never forget. But you know, when you tell somebody what they've done wrong the night before, the next day, 12 to 15 times, how can you forget it? And my tongue was my biggest weapon. And it hurt a lot. But you know, coming to places like this and rooms like this and meeting people like y'all and practicing these 12 steps in my life, I know today that I did not make another person an alcoholic. And I know today that I cannot sober up another person. But I know today that I'm primarily responsible for me, and only then am I worthwhile to help anyone else. And that's the way I try to live my life. I try to live a life that is pleasing to my God and to another fellow person that's in this program. Y'all give us back a home that used to be a house. You give us back a family. You give me back a man that I love, that he's my best friend today. If I would have wrote down what I expected out of this program, and that's all I got, I would have cut myself short. And I want to thank y'all for all of this, because it's because of you and my God that I have the life that I have today. Thank you.